Matt. I'm the minister here at Maybridge. If we haven't met, then an additional welcome to you. So what we do each week, we look at something in the Bible in this time, and we're continuing our series that we call Radical King. And if you're new or you haven't heard a lot of the rest of this series and you're wondering, what is this? What's going on? Let me just say very briefly, as a church, we're looking at Matthew's gospel bit by bit, week by week. It's one of the greatest things ever written. It's shaped all of Western civilization, and it's basically the eyewitness story of Jesus' life. But nearly all of it is focused on the last 3 years of his life and his ministry, and then his death and resurrection at the end. And so far in this story, we've seen him teaching and doing miracles and working with his immediate group of followers called disciples. And the reason we're looking at this is that each time we look at a different passage in Matthew's gospel, we learn more about him. And also while we're doing it, we learn more about ourselves. Because this one amazing book does not only show us what God is like through Jesus, but it also shows us what people are like when Jesus interacts with them. And so often we see ourselves in some of the characters in this story, and certainly I think we do today. Anyway, we're in chapter 26 of 28, closing in on the end, but these last chapters are really intense and serious because the most important thing in history that's ever happened is happening in this story at this point. And I've realised I don't have a clicker, so Bruce, are you all right to click for me? Thank you. So it's hard to overstate this. How important it is. 2 weeks ago, we saw Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, which is on the outskirts of Jerusalem. It's the night before he gets killed, and he's in absolute anguish. He's literally sweating blood, a condition that medics have observed and called, Joe, correct me on this, hematidrosis. She shrugged her shoulders. Joe's a nurse. If she doesn't know, then it's fine. Ignore me. All right. This is when you're under so much distress that your capillaries burst. And this happens to Jesus before anything physical has been done to him, okay? He's just there praying, and he's in massive distress because he's beginning to face dying for humanity to take away our sin and make a relationship with God possible for every person. So it's hard to overstate. This is a scene of great tension and stress, and there is more pressure on Jesus than ever before. And it's helpful to realize that's the scene, that's what's happening, when we look at how Jesus behaves in today's passage. Because the story continues in the garden and it becomes less of a profoundly terrible spiritual experience and it becomes a profoundly terrible, very human experience. And we're going to look at the story a bit at a time. So here we go. Bruce has already got it on the screen. Matthew 26. And it says, while he was still speaking, that's Jesus, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. So this happens. Jesus is in the middle of telling his followers what's going on, and this gang shows up. And it's mostly a mob, basically, sent by the religious leaders of the day who don't like Jesus at all. But the group is led by Judas. Now, we looked a little bit at Judas a few weeks ago. But just to touch on this, who is this guy? The name Judas has historically become famous for the idea of betrayal. So even if you're not a Christian, you have nothing to do with church, you're probably aware that Judas is not a cool name, right? No, my son is called Judah, and people have said, oh, is it Judas? And we go, no, definitely not. It's Judah, it's not Judas. That's an association that we're not looking for. Okay, who is this guy? Well, he's one of the 12, Jesus' closest 12 followers. In other words, he's been in the inner circle. He's one of his good friends for several years. And they've traveled together, and they've eaten together, and they've shared jokes, and Judas has been given responsibility. He's probably the accountant out of the group, the money guy. So he's trusted. So to be betrayed by somebody like that is about as brutal as it gets, isn't it? And I wonder if you've ever been deeply betrayed by someone. I really hope not, but I'm sure a number of us in this room will have been. And if that's you, you'll know it's a terrible thing. Disappointment, anger, confusion, all rolled into one. And here in the garden, it's exactly what happens to Jesus. Shall I just do an air click? There we go, click. Now, the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man, arrest him. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. So Judas has a plan to identify Jesus in the garden. Now, bear in mind, it's the first century, it's nighttime, there's no street lighting, it's very dark. Just pointing to him might not have worked. They want to make absolutely sure they get the right man, because from their point of view, they're thinking, well, we don't want him to escape. But it also stands out that what Judas does, because in that culture, greeting your rabbi or teacher with a kiss was meant to be it was a common sign of respect. And so by his action of kissing Jesus, Judas is saying, I respect and honour you. But in reality, he's saying, I'm here to have you taken away and killed, and I'm just IDing you. In effect, through this, what Judas is doing is saying, I know best. Jesus, I've seen you teach, I've seen you do great things, but despite what I've seen, I think the best thing here is for you to be taken down, for you to be taken out of the picture. So I'm going to act on that. Jesus replied, do what you came for, friend. Now don't miss this. Look at what this says about Jesus and what Jesus is like. He's in this scene where he's troubled to the point of sweating blood. That's literally been happening up to this moment. And his close follower comes to betray him. And what does Jesus say? No rage, no reaction. Do what you came for, friend. Do what you came for, friend. Jesus has been completely betrayed here by a terrible friend and a terrible follower, but he still addressed him as friend in that moment. And I wonder, as this happened, what happened inside Judas? Was there a terrible sinking feeling, guilt, anguish? We don't know. Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Now, we know from another account of this story, the one in John's Gospel, that it was Peter who cut off the man's ear. And if you know anything about Peter, this is classic Peter behavior. Right, he's the sort of person, he just dives in without thinking, no questions asked. And to be honest, it's not always helpful. And this is one of those times. And Jesus replies, put your sword back in its place, Jesus said to him. For all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But then how would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way? Jesus does not want to turn this into a fight. People who make it about swords end up getting killed by them. And he makes it very clear to Peter that this is 100% not a fighting moment. If it was a fight, Jesus would win. He makes it clear he can call on 12 legions of angels. A legion was 5,000 men in the army. 12 legions, therefore, do the maths, 60,000 angels. And angels aren't soft like they are in paintings. They're warriors. So if it's a mob of maybe 100 blokes with clubs from Jerusalem and 60,000 angels and it's a fight, who's going to win? It's the angels, isn't it? Jesus doesn't need help. He's saying, look, if it was a fight, I'd win. The thing at stake here is not that I lack power and I need you, Peter, to back me up. He has plenty of power, but how he sees and uses power is completely different to how the world works. He's got a different agenda, different approach. He's not concerned with a flurry of strength, but in his words, fulfilling scripture. That's what Jesus says. This is what I'm doing, fulfilling scripture. But what does he mean? 12 times in Matthew's Gospel alone, the author talks about the Old Testament being fulfilled in something that Jesus does. Jesus sees his life and his purpose as being entirely set up, predicted, driven by what everybody could read for themselves in the Old Testament. That, you know, in a sentence, that's what Jesus is doing, is he's fulfilling the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament, you may or may not know this, was written over the course of about 1,000 years, and it was finished centuries before Jesus was born. And in it, it predicted dozens and dozens of things about the life and purpose of a Messiah figure, a Saviour. And Jesus would have known all of this stuff very well growing up. But here's a few examples of some of the things that it says in the Old Testament about this future Messiah. Firstly, from the Old Testament book of Micah, which was written about 700 years before Jesus walked the earth, it says where the Messiah would be born. It says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, though you're small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." I love this. There was actually several villages in Israel at the time called Bethlehem, but it even says which one. It's specific. It's Bethlehem Ephrathah. It's that one. The one just outside Jerusalem. That's where this special person's going to come from. Elsewhere, Isaiah 53, written 800 years before Jesus was born, and before crucifixion, Roman crucifixion, had even been invented. It explains both how the Messiah was going to come and how he would die and why. And it says, "Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all." Elsewhere in Psalm 22, it says this, "Dogs surround me, a pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment." All of that happened in the run-up to Jesus' death, and perhaps even starting with the scene that we're in. This is just a taste. There are, as I said, dozens of direct or indirect predictions and hints about what Jesus would do. And I've got to say, personally, one of the reasons I'm a Christian is that there's no good explanation for how Jesus fulfilled all these things that were written centuries before, other than that it's true. It was the incredible plan of God from the beginning. Anyway, back to the passage. "In that hour, Jesus said to the crowd, 'Am I leading a rebellion that you've come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But all this has taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled.' Then all the disciples deserted him and fled." Why does Jesus say this? Now, it's all obviously very true. They could have arrested him on many occasions. He was teaching in public in very high-profile places, in daylight. I think Jesus wants to highlight how this mob with their clubs and swords might look very intimidating, but actually, like most people who try to assert power by force, they're controlled by fear. The reason they don't arrest Jesus during daylight is they're afraid of public opinion. So they take the cowardly, easier option and come and get him at night. But yet again, Jesus says this is why, so that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled. Again, Old Testament stuff. And here's the contrast. They want control, but they don't have it and they're scared. Whereas God is in control and Jesus knows exactly what's going on. He knows the dynamic at play here. And it's right at this moment. It says this short, but I think it's a chilling phrase. "Then all the disciples deserted him and fled." This is maybe not as bad as what Judas did, but it's still a betrayal. When things have gotten difficult and it becomes clear Jesus is not going to respond with force, they're out of there. It doesn't say that any of them were going to be arrested. They're just there. But all 11 of them, minus Judas, all 11 of them, the guys that have been with Jesus nonstop for 3 years, seen all this amazing stuff, now they go. They disappear into the night. And so while a couple of weeks ago in the previous passage, we saw how the ordeal of the cross began in the garden and Jesus felt the face of God the Father turn away from him and it needed to happen, that is paired with this passage of seeing his human friends turn away from him and he's totally alone. And he has to go through this. Hang around for the rest of this series because, spoiler, it ends well. But Jesus has to go through isolation and trauma and brokenness to fulfill the plan of God that was there from before the world began. What a story. For today, I want to just close by bringing our attention to what this little passage says about following Jesus badly. Now, you might think that's a strange thing to do because we don't want to follow Jesus badly. As a church, that's very much not our aim, right, in general. But hear me out, and I'll tell you at the end why do it this way, why this matters. So here's some things, how to follow Jesus badly. Disclaimer on the screen, don't do this, okay? This is not to do it, this is to avoid, just to be really clear. How to follow Jesus badly. The first thing is, think that you know best. Think that you know best. When you first read this story, the characters of Peter and Judas, at first look, they're on opposite sides, aren't they? Judas betrays Jesus, but Peter defends him. That's the opposite, right? Actually, they've both got the same core problem. They both think that they know best. Judas thinks he knows best because he interrupts what Jesus is doing to get him arrested and killed. And people speculate about Judas's motives. We know that he was paid to betray Jesus, but quite probably that's not the only reason. We know he was a political activist before he met Jesus. Many people say, well, maybe he was disappointed. Jesus was not going to use political force to beat up the Romans and kick all of them out. And so maybe this is all trying to leverage Jesus, trying to force him to step up his game and be the sort of Messiah that he wants. In other words, Judas knows best. Peter, on the other hand, is impulsive and he's passionate and he wants to protect Jesus, which seems really admirable, but it's another type of control. He doesn't trust Jesus to be in control or to play out this situation the right way. He doesn't ask him. He just dives in. Peter knows best. Neither Judas or Peter understands that suffering and dying is exactly what Jesus is planning to do. He's told them several times, we see it in the Gospels, he's told them several times that this is going to happen, and they haven't listened. And so often in life, in the Christian life, you know, we say that we follow Jesus, we don't listen either. We say we follow Jesus, but we've got our politics and our ethics and our views of right and wrong and our feelings about how life should be going, and we haven't listened. Because we assume that we know best. Jason knows best. Jonah knows best. He doesn't. Should have picked on someone else. Linda knows best. And it's our problem. We all have some Judas and some Peter in us. And that might sound shocking. We've all got plans for Jesus where we want him to do what we want. And if he doesn't, we'll oppose him. And we'll take over. And we'll be in charge. Every single person on earth does this. We do. Second thing, divide people into goodies and baddies. Again, remember how to follow Jesus badly. Divide people into goodies and baddies. When Peter pulls out the sword, he's thinking, Jesus, I'm with you. I'm one of the good guys. Let's get some judgment executed on these bad guys. Let's go for it. The adrenaline must have been pumping through his veins. It's like the final battle scene in 1,000 films where the good guys all rally and they defeat the bad guys and we're all rooting for them and then they win in the end. But it's not quite the story that we live in. There is good and evil, and of course evil is, you know, we don't want it, it must be defeated, but the story's a bit different. Peter thinks, like probably most of us, maybe all of us do about ourselves, that he's one of the good guys. He's on Team Jesus, how much more good can you get? But he's got it wrong. Jesus says, put down the sword. Put it away. Here's the problem. If you think that you're good and you're on the good team, you will always end up wielding the sword at whoever is not on your team. You will naturally look down in judgment against anybody who disagrees with you. Whether it's those lot over there who are, they're too conservative, or those lot over there, well, they're too liberal, or those lot who are too serious, or those lot who are too silly. Whatever the issue is, if you see yourself as good and the other as bad, you cannot help but stand in judgment, hand ready on your sword. But everything that Jesus does and is says that it's not like that. He's the main character in a story where actually everybody is a rebel that needs rescuing. None of us is righteous enough to get out the sword, are we? And what Jesus communicates to Peter is that actually he needs to be slain by a sword of judgment, not wield it in a show of strength. This is a story where the only one who could truly have used the sword against us instead stood in the way of it. And so the way of Jesus is not to divide the world in two and put yourself on the good team. We live in a very different story. And the only way to have genuine humility and love for other people without judgment, which is what everybody in the world, certainly in the Western world, is right now saying we want the world to be like, the only way to do this is to see yourself as no better than the other, to put away the sword, to let Jesus take the hit for you, to live in light of that. Third way to follow Jesus badly is to try to use power to get results. Judas uses power to get Jesus to react. He brings an armed mob. Peter picks up the sword because he thinks, like many people think, the way that you get the best outcome is through power, is through force. How much of the way that the world works is through people or groups or armies getting their way through who is the strongest? So much of the world is like that, isn't it? Here's the counterintuitive reality. What Jesus does, what he shows us on the cross and this whole thing, means that the world's values about power are wrong. The way to really change the world for the better is by serving people, not conquering them. Now, you might hear that and think, well, I can get on board with that. You know, it's good to serve people. And, I'm not a powerful person. I couldn't possibly even try to get my way through exercising power. I'm not big and strong. Power looks like all sorts of things. It's not only through being bigger and stronger than the next person. When we try to get results by power, it can take many forms. It could be using our words to manipulate a situation. It could be gossiping to take someone down. It could be cutting words of criticism. It could be controlling money. It could be talking over somebody. It could be quietly using people to get our way. There are a million ways to wield power that we internally justify without a second thought. Peter and Judas are just more brazen about it, more outward. But the way of Jesus is actually to empty yourself of power. Not to be a doormat, of course, not to be indifferent to suffering, but to say, I'll put my sword away and use what influence I have for the good of other people. God's way of changing the world, which Jesus modeled for us, is not superior force. It's the power of the cross, which means for us that what is modeled is a way that is much harder and much slower than just exercising whatever power we have. So that is how not to follow Jesus. And we've all done it. I'm willing to bet that everybody in this room at some point has thought that they know best, even better than God. Everyone has turned the world into goodies and baddies and put themselves on the good team. And everyone has used power in some unhealthy way to leverage what they want. Turns out that Peter and Judas are all of us, doesn't it? Why am I telling you this? Isn't this a bit negative and depressing? All the way through Matthew's gospel, we're given loads of examples and teaching on following Jesus in every area of life. And it's good, and we've been doing that as a church, and that's the right thing to do. We want to follow Jesus, we want to know what it looks like. But when it comes to the crunch, in the most important things, when it comes down to it, we can't do it. We maybe get some bits and pieces of following Jesus right, here and there. But human nature always gets in the way. Early on in his friendship with them, Jesus turned to Peter and Judas and said, follow me. And it was that simple. And they sort of do for 3 years. Until the point when it really matters. And it's life and death. And they can't do it. They're still them. And when we can't do it, when we can't follow Jesus, because on some level we reject him, we won't be with him, we won't follow him, we won't do what he says, what we are left with, if not our own abilities and our own passion and, you know, doing it right ourselves, what we're left with is only one thing. It's him in our place. That's all we're left with. He goes to the cross alone for us with no help and support from us whatsoever. And that's what this story is really about. We come face to face and acknowledge our poor following. But also in this moment, we get reassured that in that final moment, our faith is not about how good we are at following him. Thank God, it's what's on the screen. It's that Jesus didn't come to wield the sword, but to step in front of it for us. Didn't come to wield the sword, but step in front of it for us. How incredible. In the moment of the greatest rejection by his friends, and you can include us in that, in the moment of his greatest rejection by his friends, Jesus did what all our good intentions and smart ideas and turning over new leaves and all our hopes could never do. Because God loves us. And even in our worst, our moments of betrayal and rejection, he still calls us friend. Just like he did to Judas, he still calls us friend.